The readings this morning both have emotional content that's pretty strong, but they're beautiful. The first reading comes from an essay called "It's All Gratuitous." It's All Gratuitous by M.J. Ryan, who is probably most well known to you by her phrase, "random acts of kindness." In this essay, she is quoting not herself, but a woman she knows very well.
My only son died 5 years ago. He was 4 and a half. For the first year, I allowed grief to wash over me whenever I needed to. And I let myself be open to the healing that surrounds us in this incredible world. I had time for a hug and to talk with my friends. I had vast amounts of time to cherish 4 and a half years of memories. Nowadays, I realize how lucky I am not to have lost my son, but to have had him for as long as I did. Gratefulness. Or great fullness, as Brother David Steindl Rast calls it, is the full response of the human heart to the gratuitousness of all that is. He reminds us that truly every single thing we have has been given to us, not necessarily because we deserve it, but gratuitously for no known reason, and that the same is true for every living thing. We are connected one to another, to sky and water and tree and snake. By virtue of being here together as part of the wheel of life, whatever source we believe is the giver, some concept of God or the randomness of the Big Bang, the fact of our incarnation, the fact of the lizard's skin, the rose's scent, the blueness of the sky is an incredible gift. None of us, bee, flower, person, did anything to earn this gift, nor is anything required of us in return.
The second reading comes from the same poet that I quoted last week, Carl Dennis, of Buffalo, New York, and it's called, appropriately for this coming sermon, Grace.
The thought of the woman you couldn't made happy by someone else, will have to trouble you less than it does now. If you want to disprove the doctrine of the fall and enter the world of grace unbounding. On the day you cross the border, you'll be free. The town she left won't seem so tiny, the streets so empty and predictable. Linger too long with your book at dinner and you'll miss the walk to the river at dusk, where the rare, shy creatures make their appearance. Then, if you walk away from the town's glare to watch for a few of the brightest stars, you won't be doing it to impress her, to prove that you can be intimate with the beautiful without a craving for ownership. You'll be enjoying the stars for their own sake. There they'll be, Vega, Spica, Aldebaran, high above the sagging roof of a barn. On the walk back, you'll linger at the outskirts, pausing at an open window to listen. With the radio waves free of the daytime clutter, talk shows from Phoenix and Memphis will be coming in clear. Now they seem like a mixture of rancor and confusion. Then they'll sound like half-truths waiting to be fused by a power within you still not discovered. It will be easy then to love the truth just for itself, to be content with its cool, impersonal light. No need to believe that your contentment, if she learned of it, would give her the pleasure she's always wanted. You'll want to believe she has pleasure enough of her own making, should she need to make it, should her new friends prove unreliable. But if they do, you won't be happy. Not then, when the sweet water of grace begins to flow.
A couple of weeks ago in this series about the concepts of God and grace, I mentioned my friend Bonnie down in Chile. She had emailed me that she and her family had survived the terrible quake because they chanced to be vacationing together down in Patagonia, which is mercifully far from Concepcion, the epicenter of that awful quake. But by this week, all the phone lines between the United States and Chile had been restored, and I was actually able to talk with Bonnie on the phone. We spoke of all the people, over 2 million, now homeless because their houses had been reduced to rubble, and living on the beaches because their fragile homes just collapsed. We spoke of the politics behind the differing reported death tolls. The official government number is around 1,000. The actual number circulating in the outlying areas is way higher, closer to 100,000. No matter what you believe, it's the worst earthquake in South America since 1960, and it will take Chile many, many years to recover and rebuild, maybe even many decades. In that same sermon, I quoted this sentence from the Hebrew scripture: God was not in the earthquake. I was pointing out that even in ancient times, at least some authors thought it was pretty foolish to attribute death and destruction to God or anything other than natural force. But Bonnie told me that one of her farmhands, who had proudly just finished high school, knew exactly why and how the earthquake happened. And he was echoing the opinions of dozens of his friends, too. Here's what they think: the United States of America caused it. The U.S. of A. was getting jealous about how good the Chileans had been doing economically, and so just as they deliberately orchestrated the coup in Chile back in the 70s, helping to overthrow elected President Allende and installing the unelected dictator Augusto Pinochet, they decided to interfere one more time. This time, the farmhand assumed, by pressing some secret button somewhere, thus causing the destructive earthquake. Now, of course, this earthquake happened like all earthquakes happen. the slippage of tectonic plates and all of that stuff, to use the jargon. But the opinion of the farmhand and his friends remains instructive. For me, they are examples of a frequent human assumption across all cultures that there has got to be some meaningful reason why things happen. And since the progressive population of Chile is indeed still traumatized by what we did 40 years ago, they came up with this fantastic solution that, although factually false, seems to fit a pattern familiar to them. After all, they knew very well that Henry Kissinger, United States Secretary of State at that time, had boldly claimed, without any apparent sense of embarrassment or shame, quote, "The issues involved are much too important for the Chilean voters to be left to decide for themselves," unquote. Such an arrogant statement 40 years ago is hardly proof of American agency in earthquakes in the year 2010, but it illustrates how deep the impulse is to find the reasons why and how, especially when something horrific happens. The conspiracy theorists jamming the so-called tea parties may often be over the top completely with their paranoid explanations, and conservative religious types like the well-known Pat Robertson comes across as just plain gonzo sometimes when blaming bad weather on God's wrath. But both party and pastor, as wrong as they are still doing something that many of their co-citizens of Earth also do every single day, albeit in a much more modest way. They look for reasons why. I think I understand. At least sometimes I do. I too sometimes want to ask why and how, like when my best friend dies at age 40, when someone I love is diagnosed with a terminal illness, when the young man whose alcohol intervention team I sat on 15 years ago jumps off of his alcohol wagon and kills himself by drinking, when I see someone begging on the street, or when I learn of some injustice tearing apart an immigrant family with children, I find myself wanting to find out why and how too. Maybe I even try and look for someone to blame. It's often a serious struggle with me to avoid doing that. Long, long ago, a North African bishop from the town of Horseville, or Hippo, named Aurelius Augustinus, in his day Saint Augustine, in our own day, came up with my all-time least favorite explanation for why bad things happen to good people. His explanation: there are no good people. We are all born broken and deserve anything we get. Only the clemency, in Latin gratia or grazia, of God allows us to live at all. This gratia, this clemency, which we now pronounce in English with a long A as grace, was granted to us by God even though we deserve nothing but rejection, every one of us. This clemency, this gratia, this grace is a free gift. We only have to receive it. Those who don't receive it are cut off from God forever. And strangely, you need this grace even to receive it in the first place, since nothing personally that you do counts for anything. Some receive this clemency and grace, some do not. Too bad, the end. In time, people in Europe responded to this painfully strange system in two ways. Many heretics, like Giordano Bruno, some of the women called the Beguines, the brilliant mystics like Eckhart or Suso or Juliana of Norwich or Catherine of Siena, questioned Augustine's way of looking at things. They simply responded, Fine, grace. Everything is grace. Every part of the universe, every moment, every raindrop, every ray of sun, star, wave, everything is the free gift of the love at the center of all things. Call it the Godhead, call it the Spirit, call it the mystery of the universe, call it whatever you want. Everything is grace. Later, during the Age of Enlightenment, many people responded to St. Augustine's way of looking at things in a somewhat different way. Instead of saying that everything is grace and reinterpreting God to resemble something a lot more kind and welcoming, they balked. They said, there is no loving God or Spirit at the heart of the universe. There may have been, said President Adams and President Jefferson, for example, some divine force that put everything into motion once upon a time, but that force is hardly holding our hand, kissing us, and keeping us safe, or shedding grace on any of us. So let's be honest about it. Later on, after Darwin and Freud, many Western thinkers even dumped what Jefferson had poetically called nature's God and said, there isn't even that. The universe just exploded into existence long ago, and in that universe, some people are lucky and some people are not. And that's it. There is no ultimate meaning to any of it, and we're not so sure that luck is anything but a foolish metaphor. It's not much better than the word God, but it's the best we can come up with. The end. But when you heard the readings I read this morning, you received news of another way of looking at things, a way I think that combines somewhat the various historical reactions to St. Augustine's use of the word grace, and which might prove helpful to at least some of us gathered here today. The first author, M.J. Ryan, echoes my sermon from last week. She is simply not concerned with what words people describe intimacy or what is final in their lives. She writes, whatever source we believe is the giver, some concept of God or the randomness of the Big Bang. In other words, she is simply not going to downshift divinity into an impersonal force like Jefferson did by his term in the Declaration of Independence, nature's God. Nor is she going to argue with the atheists of the 19th and 20th centuries who often insist that folks best not use the word God at all. M.J. Ryan wants you to decide, you personally and no one else, and for yourself only, based on your own life and your own experience and your own personality and your own cultural assumptions, what words you're going to use or not use. But she doesn't offer us this very democratic idea at the beginning of her passage. No. She begins her passage with something she considers far more important. She wants us to know that she's not naive about human experience or the human condition. So she tells us of a mother who has lost her son at age 4 1/2. I assure you that after more than 3 decades of congregational ministry, I at least would have to consider such an experience to be the most painful I could possibly imagine. The second reading, the poem Grace by Carl Dennis, also talks about loss, the end of a marriage in this case. I've known that loss, so have many others in this room. Unlike the woman who wrote the first reading, our poet does not offer us any opinion about ultimacy or what words we use or don't use for it. Instead, he starts right off the bat by attacking St. Augustine's why and how sad things happen. He offers this little homily right at the beginning of his poem. The thought of the woman you couldn't make happy by being made happy by somebody else will have to trouble you less than it does now, If you want to disprove the doctrine of the fall and enter the world of grace abounding, the doctrine of the fall, Augustine's terrible claim that there are no good people on the earth and that each of us is born rotten to the core. But just as M.J. Ryan leaves it up to us personally to decide which name, if any, we will give to what is ultimate for us, so Carl Dennis says it's entirely up to us to disprove the doctrine of the fall, to disprove St. Augustine's paranoid theory. How? How do we do that? By allowing, he says, the sweet waters of grace to flow. Grace, the English pronunciation of the Latin word gratia. And our other author this morning, M.J. Ryan, uses that other word in English that stems from the Latin word gratia, namely gratefulness, to make the exact same case. Listen again to the mother's difficult, beautiful words. Nowadays, I realize how lucky I am not to have lost my son, come on, but to have had him for as long as I did. Gratefulness, or gratefulness, as Brother David Steindl-Rast calls it, is the full response of the human heart to the gratuitousness of all that is. He reminds us that truly every single thing we have has been given to us, not necessarily because we deserve it, but gratuitously for no known reason, and that the same is true for every living thing. We are connected one to another, to sky, to water, to tree and snake, by virtue of being here together as part of the wheel of life. Carl Dennis describes the grace of our interconnection with all things in this universe in a different but no less beautiful way. Then, he writes, if you walk away from the town's glare to watch for a few of the brightest stars, you won't be doing it to impress her, to prove you can be intimate with the beautiful without a craving for ownership. You'll be enjoying the stars for their own bright sakes. There they'll be, Vega Spica Aldebaran, high above the sagging roof of a barn. Thus, you can see that the alternative to Augustine's theory is this. It's gratitude. It's abundant grace. Both authors, much like the author of the biblical book of Job, are asking each of us to give up the idea that the unfair distribution of suffering, loss, and death has any cosmic meaning. Whether you name ultimacy God, or Gaia, or Spirit of Life, or Big Bang, notwithstanding, they are saying that focusing on living a non-vengeful life, a life without any sense of entitlement at all, a life of gratitude and courtesy and gracefulness and kindness, is a much healthier path than assigning blame for human suffering to either God or, just as bad, to luck, to chance. Both authors, I think, are joining with the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, who I quoted at the top of your orders of service, who thinks it's more important to simply accept that the universe is, than to think we can figure out why or how it got here. And that it might even be better to keep silent about such things, or at least to answer the question, why is there something rather than nothing, with a resounding, who knows? In fact, our story about the farmer this morning, which comes ultimately from a famous Zen Buddhist teacher, reminds us that who knows applies to most cause and effect sequences in this world. There is simply no place for any of us to stand with any sufficient perspective and vantage that might even help answer the whys and hows of cosmic events. And listen, neither author this morning is saying that the oppressed on this on this earth need to accept their suffering or any fool thing like that. Nor does their understanding that everything is a gift, a grace, a gratuitousness we did not earn mean that organizations like Bread are wasting their time or that Bob Letcher should have stayed home. On the contrary, such organizations, such actions are the very embodiments of M.J. Ryan's assertion that we are connected one to another, to sky and water and tree and snake, by virtue of being here together as part of the wheel of life. In other words, no one belongs on this earth more than anyone else. There are no more important genders, colors, sizes, and so forth. Thus, in joyful response to that reality, and despite our own personal and painful losses, and despite all of our suffering, this profound idea of gratefulness, grace, inspires us to work in the world to make sure that no one is shoved aside by those claiming they are more important or have more grace from God than we do. As suggested by our two wisdom authors this morning in critique of St. Augustine's view of our essential worthlessness, working for justice in every way we can is an expression of gratitude and grace before the gratuitousness of all things. Please, I'm not going to feel anything but grief and sorrow about the death of children or the homelessness of millions in Chile. But I hope I can maintain, in the midst of all that sorrow, a sense of gratefulness and abundant grace that energizes me to respond to every sorrow with compassion and kindness, with thoughtfulness, with organizational strength, and finally, a fully embodied love.